You're listening to the Blue Ridge True Crime Podcast, bringing you compelling true crime stories from the Appalachian Mountains and beyond. I'm your host, Alfred Dockery. Grab your hat and a lantern, and let's get on the trail.
The time the Flathead Gang blew an armored car sky high. The year 1927 was remarkable for technological feats. Charles Lindbergh made the first solo nonstop transatlantic flight from New York to Paris. Philo T. Farnsworth transmitted the first electronic TV image. Warner Brothers released The Jazz Singer, the first feature-length film with synchronized sound. On the crime front, Paul Jaworski and the Flathead Gang advanced the science of payroll robbery using explosives buried under a road to commit the first U.S. armored car robbery about 7 miles south of Pittsburgh. On March 11, William Tarr was driving a Brinks armored car carrying the payroll for the Pittsburgh Terminal Coal Company's Coverdale Mine. Two guards were in the truck with him, and two more were following in a car behind. Around noon, they turned off the main road onto Old Bethel Road. None of them knew it, but they were about to go for the ride of their lives. There were two stacks of newspaper, each weighted with a rock, beside the road about 30 feet apart. When the armored car drew even with the second stack, one of the gang, 100 yards away in the woods, touched two wires to a battery hidden in a hollow stump, triggering the dynamite buried under the road. The earth erupted, and the armored car catapulted into the air, flipped upside down, and landed on its roof. All three men inside were knocked unconscious. The second charge went off in front of the guard car, but the vehicle plowed into the 4-foot crater, and the crash rendered those guards senseless as well. In a minor miracle, none of the guards were killed. All were injured. One suffered a fractured skull. Fun fact, the gang stole the explosives the night before from the company whose payroll they were stealing. Kind of a one-stop shop, really. Jaworski and company hustled out of the woods and ran to the overturned armored car. They found the rear doors broken open and hurriedly began unloading bags of cash. They made off with more than $104,000, roughly $2 million today. Tarr regained consciousness and crawled, bleeding, out of the wreckage. One of the gang ordered him face down in the dirt. He was able to get a look at some of the gang and one of the two getaway cars. The gang had done their homework well. They knew the route and the timing of the payroll delivery. To slow pursuit, they had even cut the phone lines in advance. Jaworski had inherited leadership of the gang from Tony Torso Berchanti, who died in Pennsylvania's electric chair on June 1, 1925, for the death of passenger Edward Murphy during the July 1923 Laurel Line train robbery near Scranton, in which a $70,000 payroll was stolen from the West End Coal Company. They were renamed the Flathead Gang, mainly due to the shape of Jaworski's head. The 1920s were a simpler time, when bullying was not only acceptable, but could serve as branding for your criminal organization. Some of the early newspaper articles about the Coverdale heist still referred to them as the Berchanti Gang, Fate, and a Flat Tire. Unfortunately for Jaworski, his getaway plan fell flat. That is to say, the stolen car, a blue Stearns Knight, blew a tire and they were forced to push the vehicle into the woods and proceed on foot 2.5 miles to a nearby farm they had been using as a hideout while planning the caper. The next day, police found the car and were able to trail the bandits to the farm. Farmhouse, they arrested three suspects, including Jaworski, who they questioned for several hours. He gave them a fake name, John Smith, and claimed to have no knowledge of the holdup. The cops weren't buying it. They asked him to explain some of the items they found at the farm, including a half box of dynamite, 4 shotguns, $67 in brand new bills, a .45 caliber revolver, and a Detroit bank book showing a $5,000 deposit 2 weeks after a holdup in Mullenauer, Pennsylvania. If Jaworski had been caught with a Wile E. Coyote-style blueprint showing the Brinks car, the road, the bombs, a dotted line indicating the flight path of the armored truck, an anvil, and the roadrunner, he could not have looked more guilty. According to newspaper stories published on March 16 by the INS wire service, and the Pittsburgh Post, police tricked Jaworski into confessing by showing him a fake telegram stating that Joseph Wachowski, the farm's owner, had been arrested in Detroit and had spilled the beans about the crime. From the March 16 Pittsburgh Post, Paul Jaworski, another member of the bandit gang, who was arrested late Saturday afternoon, led the detectives to the hiding place of the loot after they had read him a fake telegram stating that Wachowski had been arrested and confessed. Police later determined that the gang had used the farm as a base of operations for several years, which may explain why Jaworski confessed not just to the Coverdale heist, but also to two robberies in which guards were killed, Ross Dennis in 1922 and Isaiah Gump in 1925. Jaworski led authorities to two packages wrapped in newspaper containing $38,000 buried on the farm. He said the remaining loot had been divided among the other gang members. More than 100 volunteers and state police searched the farm for the remaining $66,000, going so far as to plow up a nearby field. No additional cash was recovered. In April, Jaworski pled guilty to the Coverdale payroll robbery, a 1924 holdup at a saloon in Sharpsburg, and robbing one of that bar's patrons. He was sentenced to 30 to 60 years for the robberies, not less than 10 years nor more than 20 for each offense, in the Western Penitentiary. An article in the April 12 Pittsburgh Gazette notes that he pleaded guilty after numerous conferences with his court-appointed attorney, Barney Cohen, and further noted that at each conference, Jaworski seemed to decide to plead guilty to a different crime. Throughout the legal process, Jaworski seemed to show a preference for the electric chair over spending the rest of his life in prison. The murder of Isaiah Gump. In May, Jaworski stood trial for killing a guard during the Pittsburgh Terminal Coal Company holdup in Mullenauer. On Christmas Eve 1925, paymaster Leroy Putton and two guards, Gump and Mahoney, disembarked from a special Pittsburgh and West Virginia Railway pay car. They were carrying the Christmas payroll to mine number 3. Six bandits drove up in a touring car, shot Gump in the abdomen, and clubbed the other guard with a gun butt, snatched two satchels containing $48,000, and sped away in the car. Gump was rushed to a Pittsburgh hospital in critical condition. He died later that day. It was the Mullenauer robbery that convinced the company to contract out payroll delivery to the Brinks Express Company. The 3-day trial for Gump's murder started on May 17. Jaworski pleaded not guilty. First Assistant District Attorney Andrew T. Park worked hard to prove the defendant was the leader of the Flathead Gang and lay 4 major robberies committed in the last 3 years in western Pennsylvania at his feet. One newspaper article hinted that Jaworski had been willing to plead guilty if given a promise of electrocution, but the DA was unwilling to make any promises of any sort. The state tried to prove that an auto tool kit found when Jaworski was arrested at the farmhouse was stolen from the Lincoln touring car used in the Mullenauer robbery, and stressed that one of two 25-20 rifles found there could have been the weapon that killed Gump. Neither could be proven to be an exact match. It appears that it was Jaworski's farmhouse confession that swayed jurors, who returned a verdict of guilty of murder in the first degree with a recommendation of the death penalty after deliberating for less than 4 hours. It seemed Jaworski had finally gotten what he wanted, and our dark tale has reached its conclusion. But his criminal career, it turns out, was not over just yet. Daring daylight jailbreak. On the afternoon of August 18, Jaworski had a visitor at the Allegheny County Jail, later identified as his brother Sam. He talked with Jaworski through the screen for about 20 minutes and then went into the jail office. Instead of exiting the building, he went through to the other side of the cell, which had bars but no screen. He passed his brother and his cellmate, John Vassbinder, 3 45 caliber revolvers he had smuggled into the jail. Jaworski took 2 and handed a 3rd to Vassbinder. Bullets rang off the iron bars as the trio shot their way out of the jail, wounding 2 guards, seizing their keys, and opening the cell door. They forced the jail's bookkeeper to walk them to the main door, where he was relieved of his keys. The three of them sprinted to an idling car and peeled away. Two men sentenced to die in the electric chair for murder escaped from jail in broad daylight. Fun fact, a cartoon depicting the escape appeared on page 7 of the Pittsburgh Press on Friday, August 19, 1927. The Deadly Detroit News Raid. Jaworski returned to the headlines in June 1928 when he and five other men robbed the Detroit News. Around 11 a.m. on Wednesday, June 6, six men armed with sawed-off shotguns held more than 100 Detroit News workers at gunpoint, while two of them ransacked the cashier's cage, taking $14,800 of the newspaper's $65,000 payroll. Detroit News employees were working at their desk in the business offices on the building's second floor when the robbers entered with their shotguns concealed in paper bags. Jumping up on the counter, one of the bandits shouted orders for everyone to put up their hands. Another stood in the center of the room brandishing a shotgun, while a third stood at the doorway covering other employees who were lined up against the wall in the outer hallway. Two other robbers vaulted over the partition around the cashier's cage, covered the four men inside, and began scooping up money. As word spread that a robbery was underway, other employees rushed into the second floor hallway, and the robbers, becoming nervous, decided it was time to leave. They dropped some of their loot as they raced downstairs and out of the building. The bandits rushed from the building into heavy traffic on Lafayette Boulevard, where they engaged in an exchange of gunfire with two police officers. George Barstead, a traffic officer, was fatally wounded, and patrolman Guyot Craig was shot in the foot. At least two bystanders were peppered with shotgun pellets. The Detroit News immediately went to press with a story about the robbery. Their rival, the Detroit Times, beat them to the street with its own extra edition on the holdup. In fairness, the Times had less going on that day. Showdown in Cleveland. On September 13, 1928, Jaworski and a man believed to be John Vassbinder were eating at a Fleet Avenue restaurant in Cleveland. John Jaworski, a Pittsburgh grocery clerk who had been in a church choir in Butler, Pennsylvania with Jaworski many years ago, recognized him, stepped outside to a phone booth in a store across the street, and called the police. It's a small world, and it was even smaller in 1928. Jaworski told the Pittsburgh Press that he met uniformed officers outside the restaurant and warned them that Jaworski would put up a fight. I told them Jaworski was a bad man who would shoot at the sight of their uniforms, but they laughed and said I was having a pipe dream. When the police car arrived in front of the restaurant, I warned them again, and they laughed at me. I lay in the bottom of the car when they entered the place. I knew what was going to happen. When the five police officers entered the restaurant, Jaworski immediately started shooting with two handguns. He shot and killed patrolman Anthony Weisskrick and wounded patrolman George Effinger. A bystander also caught a stray bullet. While Jaworski was shooting his way out of the cafe, his companion escaped through the rear door. Jaworski ran out the front door, jumped fences, and fled down alleys, then forced his way into a two-story house. Officers followed hard on his heels, and in minutes had the house surrounded. Five tear gas bombs forced him out, and as he came onto the porch, gun in hand, patrolman Yaro Kudka fired a shotgun, hitting Jaworski in the temple and shoulder. Jaworski fell back into the house. Policemen swarmed in and dragged him out. Badly wounded, Jaworski was partially paralyzed. Ohio to Pennsylvania. Prosecutor E.A. Stanton, Cuyahoga County, Ohio, agreed on October 19, 1928, to extradite Jaworski after being assured that the gunman would receive the death penalty. Both Ohio and Michigan could lay claim to Jaworski for the death of police officers, but they recognized Pennsylvania's prior claim and saved the expense of a murder trial. The appeal of his death sentence, which was pending at the time of his escape, was rejected on October 22nd. It was really a formality. Jaworski's sister, Mrs. Catherine Logan of Detroit, petitioned for and received a 20-day delay for psychiatric evaluation for her brother. This annoyed Jaworski. Dr. E.E. Mayer examined him on January 7th and pronounced him sane. Jaworski messaged the governor asking if his execution could be moved up. He had been examined by a lunacy commission in Cleveland in October, which had also found him to be sane. They had an interesting way with words back then. His journey to Pittsburgh was on a cot in a baggage car of a train surrounded by police. Newspapers reported that Jaworski chatted and joked with detectives during the three-hour trip. The final installment. On January 21st, 1929, Jaworski, supported by two guards, On January 21, 1929, Jaworski, supported by two guards due to his paralyzed leg, entered the death chamber at precisely 7 o'clock. A reporter wrote that the 29-year-old Jaworski appeared to be in a daze. Another described him as ghost-like. As he stepped into the chair, he stumbled on the foot electrode. The guards prevented his fall, and he was seated in a chair of chained lightning. Three men, including the executioner, strapped him in. Jaworski was given his first shock at 7:02 and declared dead at 7:06. Jaworski, who killed at least six men during his criminal rampage across Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Ohio, paid the supreme penalty for the death of Isaiah Gump, the payroll guard slain in the Mullenauer robbery. Robert Elliott, official executioner for several states, threw the switch. In his book, Agent of Death, Memoirs of an Executioner, he told this story about Jaworski. Doom prisoners spend their hours in reading, writing letters, playing checkers, and the like. Paul Jaworski, notorious Pittsburgh bandit leader and confessed killer of seven men, became engrossed in a continued magazine story. When he learned that he would have to die before finishing the serial, he said, "Gee, it's tough not to know how the thing ends." The publisher heard about this and sent him an advanced copy of the final installment. The publisher sending Jaworski the final installment early had to be one of the weirdest, most wholesome forms of fan service in criminal history. On the other hand, it wasn't like he was going to tell anyone the ending.
That's it for this episode of the Blue Ridge True Crime Podcast. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It helps more people find the show. Check the show notes for links to the Blue Ridge True Crime Substack and YouTube channel, and any story-related links. Until next time, I'll look for you on the back roads.